Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor, and I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Schiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. In today's episode, we talk about the horrifying scenes playing out in Israel, the rise and fall of Freelancer, the rise and rise of the video game market, and who won the bet of the century. So another week, Adir. Welcome to the pod. What a big week it's been.
There's been too much action in the world this week is how I would describe it. And so I think we just have to make a huge effort to keep this light and fun and not to get dragged down by the negative emotions, unfortunately, that are circulating through the world. So I'm going to ask you this question, which could not be further away from the problems of the world, which is, are you a coffee drinker?
I think I had one sip of coffee about 15 years ago and that was it.
All right. So
are you a coffee? You're a coffee drinker, right?
Yeah, we've never had this conversation, but I was 95% sure the answer was going to be no, just because it wouldn't comply with some regime that you follow or something like that. Yeah, so I'm a coffee drinker. Today I've had, I'd say, five coffees, but it's unusual. And so I'm going to tell you something that I think you'll find interesting about coffee, even though you don't drink it.
Yeah.
About 2 years ago, I wanted to buy a kettle that looked really cool. And so I bought this kettle. It looks amazing. And it's got this feature where it keeps the water. You can like do 1 degree at a time and it'll keep it warm. It's very amazing. It cost $250. What do you say to that for a start?
I probably wouldn't buy that kettle, but each their own.
So it looks great. And then I discovered that the kettle has a particular use.
So just a guy called Gabby Leibovich, who's one of Australia's most successful ever entrepreneurs, is giving obscene gestures from outside this room. He's in here for a board meeting and he's really distracting me.
And I'm sure his brother, Chezi, is somewhere around as well, right?
Looking on with scorn.
Yeah. So this kettle, back to the kettle.
Sorry.
So, no, you blame Gabby for that, not you. So this kettle, turns out it's got a purpose. And that purpose is a kind of coffee that's known as pour over. Now, I didn't know anything about this pour over, but it's this particular way of making coffee. And so what I thought is, I'm going to go and learn about pour over as a kind of coffee. And it turns out it's been life-changing for me. I never used to have coffee at home because I don't like those home espresso machines.
Do you like a Greek coffee or a Turkish coffee? Is that?
No, I do love that black coffee as well. I'm going to call it black coffee because I don't want to like alienate any ethnicities as part of our podcast. I've heard it called Arabic coffee. Like in Israel, it's called Arabic coffee. In Israel, it's actually called mud in Hebrew, which is fairly accurate, I would have thought.
Yeah.
And no, this is like, literally, it's kind of like a batch brew or a filtered coffee where you pour the water over the top. It's really low in caffeine and very mild. And I've started seeing it popping up at various places. You need some equipment for it. But that is why I've had five coffees because I make it at home and I basically just sit there and make like six or seven cups worth because you can't like make one cup worth. And I just come in
buzzing. How much do you reckon? I'll get to my point in saying, how much do you reckon you spend a week? Obviously, it's gone down with this. There's a bit of depreciation of the coffee, the kettle itself. But leaving aside the dar, how much do you spend a week on?
Leaving aside the dar.
How much do you spend a week on coffee, you reckon?
So when I have coffee at home, it's not to try and replace coffees that I have out of home. It's just because, it's like, well, for whatever reason, I hadn't gone to a cafe. So I've noticed that the price of coffee, if you live, you know, in our kind of areas, is $5. That's the standard price of coffee, $5 a coffee. I've noticed if I go north of the Yarra to places that are not ultra cool, you can get it for $3.50. But anyway, it's $5.
Yeah.
Sydney, $6.
Yeah.
Gold Coast, $6, $5. I would say I probably spend $10, $10 to $15 a day.
Yeah.
On coffee. So what's that? But and the weekend would be the same.
But it's $70, $80.
Yeah,
$90 times $4,500 a year on coffee.
Yeah, that makes me feel thank you for doing the math.
That's post tax. So you actually had to earn about $9,000 to afford.
Isn't that a crazy bit of maths that you've just done there? I've never thought about that before. I find it completely remarkable to think about it in that way. It will in no way change my behaviour. Because
you're rich. So it doesn't matter.
Let's not get carried away with that because probably people from the ATO are listening to this podcast. By the way, you know these rich lists?
Yeah.
You know they are basically the handbook for the ATO. Do you know that? No, I can tell you that for a fact. Like the ATO gets these rich lists and they basically just work through them, especially the young rich list, and they just work through them and just try and decide who they're going to audit. Not everyone gets audited, but it is a handbook for the ATO.
So I wrote an article for, remember BRW before it
No, I
closed.
Love BRW. I won a pen for letter of the week from BRW. I still use it. No, I've held it for 20 years. It's a really nice pen.
I had
pen.
A BRW satchel I got for my first subscription. I reckon I have for 20 years. I got rid of it recently. But I used to write a weekly article for a year or so for BRW till it went under. So maybe I was the kiss of death there. But I wrote this article, and I remember it was always hard to come up with, like you with the Finn, it's always hard to come up with ideas. Mm. And it was a bit, because I had to write positive, it was a positive kind of magazine.
Well, that would be tough for you.
So it was tough. Yeah. So my usual shtick, which is negative, wasn't appreciated. So I had to come up with positive. So one of the articles I wrote was how Jez, my, of course, my business partner, my co-founder, we started with 70 grand. We started our first ever business when we were 24 years old. Mm-hmm. And the way we had 70 grand, we were only earning, call it 30 grand after tax back then. The way we had 70 grand is both, especially me, Jez to an extent, I didn't drink much. I never smoked. Jez never smoked. And neither of us ever drank coffee, and we never did drugs. So if you look at the amount we saved from not doing all that stuff, it was probably the amount, probably 70 grand. So our entire seed fund was called the
anti-vice seed
fund. The anti-vice, the Presbyterian, the anti-vice seed fund. And then I remember I wrote this article and Jez sent me this angry email. You made me look like a total loser. So I dragged him down into my...
Well, I'm in the same basket as you. I mean, I do drink coffee, but yeah, I also grew up not doing any of those vices. I say that I'm still looking for my vice. I haven't found it yet. I'm like, I'm hunting, but everything I try... I mean, there's a lot of things I don't try because I just think I've got an addictive personality. So it's like I'm going to go from 1 to 100 in the blink of an eye. But, you know, the reason that I said it doesn't modify, would not modify my behavior, this alarming bit of maths that you've just done for me, is because I think there are some things in life where you've just got to, they're so enjoyable and they give you these just moments of happiness that is what you should be spending money on in life. And, you know, there was this whole big tirade a while ago that the millennials were eating avocado toast.
And avocado rant.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, I kind of understood the point that was being made. It's possibly slightly judgmental. But what I more felt was they shouldn't give up the avocado toast, because if that is what makes them happy, to sit in a cafe probably with friends enjoying that, what in the heck is the point of earning money if you're not going to spend it like that?
Yeah. I don't know. If people want to take drugs or do it, I've got no issue with that. I think drugs should be legal. Fortunately, I don't like coffee. I don't like cigarette smell. I don't like alcohol. So I was able to save a bunch of money because I just happen to like that stuff. So it was more fortunate than anything else.
All of my friends drink scotch.
Yeah, a lot of people drink whiskey.
I don't even know if you call it. I don't even know what it's called. And so what I'll do is I'll just succumb to peer group pressure periodically. And so I make sure I get given a lot of alcohol as gifts.
Yeah.
And so I've got lots of alcohol.
Yeah.
And so people come over and it's pretty nice. And so I've always got something nice to open.
Yeah.
And I'll kind of labor my way through a glass of it with them. I have been known possibly after the third or fourth one that other people have had, my one might end up in the sink or in a plant or something. in reality.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It's just how you're wired, right? I think it's just how you're wired.
I used to drink a very little. I used to drink like a glass here and there. And then probably
You drink zero.
I now drink zero. Like, not to say, if you open a $10,000 bottle of Rothschild, I'd probably have it. Like, I'm not opposed to ever having
it. I don't even know what that is.
Like an expensive wine.
I wouldn't even appreciate it. Someone once opened a Grange for me. It was very nice. I drank it and they said, how amazing is it? And I said, oh, it's actually incredible. But I had no idea.
I was sitting next to my lawyer, Nick, who listens to the podcast and loves it. He did this event, this random wine taste. This is when I used to drink a little bit with Ian Botham, who was down from England. So Ian Botham, I sat next to a guy called James Blythe, who might be listening, who's obviously in the Blythe family. He's a lovely guy. And James knows a lot more about alcohol than me. And I was sitting next to James. It's the first time I met him, actually. And we're going through, and they put the cheap $15 bottle and the $500 bottle. And guess which one I preferred?
Oh, I can work it out, right? Yeah. Well, you preferred the $15 bottle even though you weren't paying and you didn't know which bottle was which. That's what's impressive. You know, we've spoken for too long because when Keelan, the producer, is looking at
his twitchy
watch.
Yeah, he is.
That's what we're
looking at overtime.
You should get into a story.
We should run a poll every week what segment people like the most. We'll get to the poll we just ran later on the show, but I'd be interested to know what's the best part of the show.
And we have data about that. I wanted to share data with listeners because podcasts, it's a black box, right?
Absolutely,
like,
black box.
I mean, I couldn't – like, I don't even know much stuff about podcasts in general.
Yeah.
This one a bit more, obviously. But we should go in between episodes, have a look at some data, and next episode let's share some data with the listeners – because nobody else is going to tell the truth about. Well, I mean, we're not going to tell the entire truth, but nobody else is going to tell the truth.
What these data can give is our listenership is about 30% up week on week, which is pretty incredible. If you can get 30% growth on any business, not that we're a business per se, but 30% growth on anything is pretty impressive. So thanks
30% week on week growth is, it's got to be like a 50x revenue multiple valuation.
1,000x. We just like got to 50, get 30. Imagine if you manage 30%. That's like, I don't know what percentage growth that is because it's exponential, but yeah. that's no one achieves that. But obviously, our growth will at some point slow, probably this week. But it was great to get huge growth last week. Obviously, Gav Appel episode was super popular. This week's episode has been really popular.
I want to say the maths, 1.3 to the power of 52. That's the maths for the growth, isn't it? 30% a week?
Yes. Yes, exactly. There you go.
That's it. That's all I had to say about that.
Yeah.
Oh, Gav was very popular. Which is very disappointing. I told him that nobody liked him, which I'm happy to say that openly because I assume that he only listens to the podcast that he's on. So, but yes, I got a lot of very positive feedback about
great.
Him.
And we'll certainly get him back on as a semi-regular guest, no doubt. So let's go to our first official story for the week.
So we're going to try something a bit different, Adam. I want to talk to you about one of our sponsors. You know that I used to have like a digital marketing agency, and so I know a fair bit about this space. The sponsor that we've got here, they're called Bench Media. They've basically developed an approach to this, which I think is pretty innovative. And instead of going to one particular agency, buying from a particular agency and engaging with them, it's essentially they've got a platform, and you go onto that platform, and they've got a whole ton of data and media partners there. Like they've got 100 data and media partners, and you know, you put your various needs on there, whether it's digital or it's out of home, which is billboards or whatever it might be, and effectively they match you. That feels to me, have you heard of anything else that's like that before?
I haven't. I know when we buy our media, we have a digital agency, we do a bit in-house, and we use there's another agency for out of home, there's another agency for radio, there's another agency for TV. We have our own agency. It's really confusing, and it's really hard to... I think the one really good thing that one of the many good things that Bench Media do is they do some really good attribution. So one of the big things about brand marketing is 50%, as classically say, 50% works, but you don't know which 50%. And what these guys do is some media mix modeling and path to acquisition, some really smart things that help. You don't have to be super sophisticated billion-dollar marketing budgets to be able to use the tools they built. So they really take what usually start at the enterprise level and bring it to small businesses and medium businesses.
Yeah, I think, to me that's like, this is a really interesting sponsor for us to have, to be honest. Like, I think this is quite novel and innovative. I will say what they said to me in pitching was, like, you need, if you spend $1 million a year, like, this solution can work. And I thought, you know, that's like something worth taking a look at and pretty interesting. And they said to me their customers include Nestle, Samsonite, Epson. So, like, there's some serious companies that are using them. So I reckon actually it's pretty interesting and like worth a look.
I think Cricket Australia as well. I think there's some really big customers, and I'm super happy to work with agency and a platform that is really taking to the next level. So if you want to speak to Bench Media, you can give them a call on 1-300-049-498, or you can go to benchmedia.com and see what they can do to take your media marketing mix to the next level. And our first story refers to, of course, the horrific tragedy that's unfolding in Israel and Gaza, as Israel continues to lead headlines as the IDF launches its retaliation against Hamas. Adir, while this isn't a tech and business issue specifically, the geopolitical ramifications of the conflict are significant, and the relevance of Israel to so many of our listeners is huge. How do you see everything playing out from here?
So I'm going to take this conversation in a slightly different direction, because what was going through my mind as you were asking that question is I'm going to try and talk a bit about Iran and how this is all actually Iran. And then I thought, what would be more interesting to talk about, or you can steer me in the other direction if you want, but what would be more interesting is the impact on this of this on Australia and on Australian society. And the reason I talk about that in this context of a business podcast is because I'm a big believer that business is like a second level activity that you conduct, and it is predicated on the base on certain things about the base level. And our base level is a Western liberal democracy with a capitalist economy and certain freedoms and liberties. My personal view is that too many people in business are too reluctant to engage in any conversations that could fall into this kind of broader idea of politics. I don't mean party politics. I mean what I'm about to say now. And I think it's a tremendous mistake. You know, Hannah Arendt, who was like the philosopher and was probably the expert on totalitarianism and wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem, one of her biggest complaints was the complete disengagement of people who focus on making money above any sharing any views or engagement or input in broader society. And so my view on this and its impact on Australia is I think we have become too timid, being proud to protect the core values that our societies stand for. So as an example, obviously there were some protest marches in Sydney that have got a lot of publicity where some pretty horrific things were said from, you know, the point of view of people with people, human beings in general, and people that had Holocaust surviving grandparents, like gas the Jews, kill the Jews, whatever it is. And so what happened there is clearly a mistake. Like Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, came out very apologetically, took personal responsibility. I don't think you can continue to criticise people when they apologise and take personal responsibility. That's all you can ask for from people. But I think what happened is that there was this line of police there, like not beat police, like serious police, and they were all standing in front of the Opera House because they were worried that there would be damage to the Opera House. And they tried to avoid a confrontation with lots of protesters. But there were quite a few police, dozens. And I think somehow the decision was made to protect an iconic building ahead of protecting the values of society. And my personal view is iconic buildings are worthless if there are no underlying virtues and values in society to stand for. And so I think the biggest change, I hope, that this makes, other than obviously people should feel safe being in their own cities and, you know, overseas hate should not come to Australia, is that I think Australians need to be less reluctant in standing up for our values rather than just trying to avoid messiness or confrontation. That's how I felt about the whole situation.
I think that's fair. I think the New South Wales police haven't got a great record on a lot of things. Lynn Siege was a disaster. This was a disaster. They arrested somebody holding an Israeli flag, of all people.
I will say in defence of them on that, because, you know, there's this big strategic mistake that was made and then you have to deal with the tactical situation in front of you. And there was one person who was holding an Israeli flag, which is totally lawful. But I think I saw the video of that. Mm. The police looked like they were terrified of this person being killed by the protesters. And I think they felt they had no choice but to arrest him for the purposes of forcing him to move on and getting him out of harm's way. So I don't blame the beat police for that. I think that the strategic decision-making put them under a lot of tactical pressure.
Yeah, that's probably right. Clearly the second-order effects of this is significant. There's obviously a lot to play out still. The geopolitical ramifications are massive, but one of Israel's great problems has been the PR war constantly gets lost because they're the big power. They're not a big, powerful country, but relative to West Bank and Gaza, they're big and powerful, and they constantly lose the PR battle. They're probably slightly winning the PR battle in this instance, only because the crimes were so horrific in the first instance, but it probably is a matter of time before they start losing it, because ultimately, as they presumably go into Gaza, and that may have happened by the time this airs, world opinion is likely to shift, and how that gets managed, and this is obviously less relevant for those in Israel because they probably don't care about what people think of them as much, but relevant to people who live in places like Australia and the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, however much you can rationalise that it's Iran and, you know, Hamas is just an extension of Iran and they put their military installations under civilian infrastructure, when kids start getting killed and innocent civilians, it's understandable to me how reason is lost. And so I'm not judgmental about that. I totally agree with you. Like, it is it's difficult to maintain.
And with that, we'll move on to our second story after this short break.
Adam, I assume you've claimed the R&D tax incentive at some point.
Oh, it's the best thing I do all year.
That's very positive. Well, I also think it's fantastic. I mean, it pays back up to 43.5% of genuine R&D, and you can get a cash payment as well as a tax incentive. But the problem that I've found is the process potentially can be a nightmare to manage.
Not only that, if you do it wrong, you actually get a really big fine from the tax office. So it's something that you want to be really careful with.
Agree. I mean, compliance is challenging. But the good news is our friends at Rimon Advisory specialise in managing the entire process and can also help claim everything that you're entitled to. They've been doing it for 12 years. I can say that I honestly actually use them for my startups, and their co-MD, Lior Steen, is really responsive in my experience. So you should go to their website, Rimon, that's rimon.com.au, where you can learn more, use their free calculators, and drop them a line. Now it's back to the contrarians.
For our second story, we take a closer look at the once high-flying Australian tech stock, Freelancer. The global freelancer marketplace, which was founded by colourful entrepreneur and zero COVID fan Matt Barry, has been one of the worst performing ASX floats in the past decade. After listing at $1.60 per share and rejecting an alleged $400 million takeover bid, Freelancer shares hit $1.79 in 2015, but it's been downhill ever since, with shareholders seeing almost 90% of the value of their investments slashed. Freelancer is rapidly approaching penny stock territory, with its market capitalization crashing to only $92 million. For the 6 months ended 30 June, Freelancer reported slowing growth, with revenue dropping from $29 million to $27 million compared to the prior year, while the business announced yet another loss, albeit reduced at $349,000. Bear in mind, these figures were helped by a falling Australian dollar, which was down 6.5%, so the underlying performance was even worse than reported. The business also has current assets of only $30 million, sitting alongside $47 million in short-term liabilities and another $20 million in other debts. Adir, Matt Barry has been outspoken on all sorts of issues, including being highly critical of opening the economy after COVID lockdowns. But it seems he should have been focusing more on his own business. Is there a chance the Freelancer doesn't survive?
Well, the first thing I want to say is your intro, the comment, what did you call Matt Barry? Colourful, what did you call him? Colourful business?
Colourful entrepreneur.
Colourful entrepreneur and zero COVID
fan.
Do you think he's going to update his LinkedIn profile with that title? Like, I've met Matt Barry. I haven't had a lot to do with him. So, you know, my views on this are not particularly personal. The question I want to ask you before I answer your question is, did they have a COVID boom? Like, did the lockdowns give a boom to Freelancer?
Surprisingly not. Its share price has been on a pretty steady decline for the last really 10 years. Yeah. The odd sort of small ray of hope. But yeah, you would have thought COVID would have helped that business.
Well, you should tell listeners a bit about what this business, like what their core business is.
Yes, the core business, I mean, they've heard a business called Upwork, very similar business. So what Matt did was he effectively rolled up, this is 12 years ago, so the model was actually pretty smart back then. So I think Matt had a previous business that I don't recall doing amazingly well, but he started this Freelancer business. He got money from Simon Clawson, who was a very successful Melbourne-based entrepreneur. I think his business was an antivirus type business or something like that, which he sold to a global business for in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So Simon Clawson, a very successful entrepreneur. Clawson backed Matt Barry probably 12, 13 years ago. And I think still the two of them control most of the stock in this business. So it's a very small, what we call free float, which has been another issue with the share price. So he got money from Simon. He basically rolled up a bunch of these Freelancer businesses. So let's say you or I want to hire, you've heard of Airtasker. It's like Airtasker for developers or for graphic designers or any sort of person you can hire really globally. So if you need to get a podcast image done, which we did for this show, I jumped on a Freelancer type platform. At a principle, I didn't use Freelancer. but I jumped on a platform, and for $30 you can get a pretty good design done, or you can spend $1,000 and get a better one. But it's essentially, how do you get people who are living in places like Bangladesh or India or Sri Lanka or China or wherever to do jobs? And it's a pretty simple marketplace. So you put the job up, people bid for it. You choose the person, you interact with them, and you pay them through the platform.
Obviously you're not a big fan of Freelancer if we didn't use them specifically out of principle, but unsurprisingly, like, I'm going to take the softer view of this, okay? And let me tell you what the softer view is. I'll be a devil's advocate, but I'll tell you the softer view. So all businesses, almost all businesses, have their golden window, I'll call it, where everything is kind of going right for them and they're on the way up. And it feels incredible, and everybody thinks the potential is infinite, and the founders think the potential is infinite. I think that's the time to sell a business, by the way. It's hard because the founders think the potential is infinite, but I think that's the time to sell a business. And a very tiny number of businesses extend that golden window and just get better and better and better, like Apple is one, and Google is maybe the best example, Microsoft, amazing.
Microsoft probably had multiple golden windows because like a new product 10 years later.
Yeah, incredible. We'll talk more about Microsoft, in another story. And so what I think may have happened here is that this is a very good idea, and Freelancer was smart in rolling these things up and seeing that this was an opportunity and effectively IPO'd for what market cap did you say when they IPO'd?
It was just under $400 million.
I mean, that's a lot.
They had a $400 million offer from, I think, from Recruit or Rakuten, one of the big Japanese conglomerates. There was question on whether that was a real offer.
But I don't think it matters. Like, he got an IPO away.
Yeah. Oh, a very small free float. So why don't we talk about what free float is, just for our listeners who may not have heard of that phrase?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So effectively, if you want to buy stock, there needs to be somebody prepared to sell it to you and vice versa. And we're in a big company like BHP or CommBank, you can always find shares to buy. Because even if you're trying to buy 2% of the company, which would be an enormous sum of money, there's enough people out there that will sell you stock. And so what that means is that the market for that stock is probably a very accurate reflection of what people think that stock is worth. And then when you get to companies that are typically smaller or where insiders hold large percentages of those companies and they're not prepared to sell, there's not much stock available for buyers that want to buy or for sellers that want to sell. And so what will typically happen is if the stock is hot, then it will move up much more quickly than it otherwise would, because you have these buyers that want stock. It's on a supply and demand curve. There's too much demand and not enough supply. That pushes prices up. But when things turn against the company, it can be disastrous because you have all these sellers pouring into the market, which is all of this like supply of stuff, and there's no demand on the other side. Nobody wants to buy. And so you've created this market where the price is probably not entirely reflective of what people think the company is actually worth, just because how little of it is trading. And you might call that thin trading or a thinly traded stock or the low liquidity stock. It's definitely one of the key problems that that exists in trading shares, and it is the problem that public markets are supposed to overcome, basically.
Well, I think what happened here is when Matt and Simon listed the business, they only sold about 10% of the shares. So 90% of the shares was owned by Simon and Matt Barry. So they weren't selling shares where they couldn't or they weren't allowed to or they didn't want to. 10% of the shares were what we call free float. It's very easy for the share price to drop significantly or increase significantly conversely, because only a small number of people need to change their mind on the stock.
Yeah. And so what I think about this golden windows is, I think Matt Barry was smart to do this roll-up. I think he saw this opportunity. You talked about Upwork. I think I would say 99 Designs was a similar kind of business in a particular niche, right? Specifically the design niche. I'm sure you remember how hot this space was. I mean, this float, small IPO or not, nobody would have paid these prices even for 10% if it wasn't hot at the time. I know that 99 Designs got their exit. They actually got a decent exit, and the guys there who, you know, they're fantastic
guys.
They got their exit. I think the challenge here that Matt Barry has faced is that the golden window for what made this business hot and sexy and popular to begin with, that golden window has closed, and he hasn't yet found the next golden window. And so that is why we're seeing falling revenues and a falling share price. And unfortunately, unlike, you know, one of the disadvantages of a public company and owning so much of it whilst being a founder and an executive, it's very difficult to get out. And I think he just never got the opportunity to get liquidity and to sell down in the way that 99 Designs got a chance to sell their business.
I think my issue, I'm just looking at the article I wrote in 2014, just after the company floated. And there was a couple of issues I had at the time. One was, Matt was claiming that actually the list price was only 50 cents. It actually tripled off the list price. So it was worth $600 million at one point. And Matt Barry was on the BRW Young Rich List at $255 million
at one
point.
Well,
Rich List, actually, not even the Young Rich List.
That's, I mean, firstly, it's amazing you could get on the Rich List with $255 million. That has changed dramatically so quickly. But also, I think that's legit. Like, that's what he was worth.
Well, I think the issue I had, there was that mysterious $400 million bid that I don't think was ever really a real bid. But I think the other thing was, he was claiming that this was the biggest marketplace for freelancers in the world. And when I did the numbers, they were about a tenth the size of what was then Odesk and Elance, which had merged and is now Upwork.
Yeah.
My view was he may have thought it was right, but it was a clearly wrong claim.
Let's call it misguided.
Misguided claim. And back then, this is 2012, or just before it floated, it was only generating cash flows of $20 million. It was a tiny, so it was on a 20 times operating cash and basis.
You mean billing $20 million
yep.
a year, not making $20
million not GTV,
a year, billing $20 million.
I don't think it ever made money, or if it made money, it was very brief. Right.
Yeah, so, but you know, like you're picking on this stock, but there are lots of stocks that are massively overvalued with like sales numbers that you think must be earnings numbers in order to justify the valuation. And so this one in particular you seem to not like. And so my view is this is a company that's missed its golden window with revenue that's going backwards. It's tough to see how they're going to get investors excited again. There have been situations where people have pulled rabbits out of the hat for this. I think the question that's more interesting for me is, why has this phenomenon come and gone? Why is this concept of booking all of these people through this platform, which Airtasker is doing as well, and
yep.
why do you think that's come and gone?
I think I love Airtasker as a business.
The Sidekick of the, would you call Sidekick of the same thing? No, that's more like getting actual people to come and do specific things.
No, I think
for
it's
you.
Similar. I think it's all similar. I like the model still. I love the Upwork model. And I don't have anything against the freelancer model. The issue I had with Matt Barry at the time was he was going around saying he was the number one marketplace in the world, hence he has a competitive advantage. You're number one. That if you're realestate.com, you're a great business. Yeah. If you're some random real estate thing that nobody's heard of, you're not a great business. So being number one with a protective moat makes you far more valuable than a distant number two. He was going around saying he's number one. He clearly wasn't number one back then. People may have, if people were stupid enough to invest at that $600 million, they've done 90% of their money.
I think Which, again, is not unique to them.
No, absolutely not. But we don't have time to talk about every single business has dropped 90%. But we're talking about this one now. And this one's been a disaster for investors. It's been a disaster for, to Matt Brary's credit, he's gone down with the ship. He was a wealthy guy. He's not on any wish list now because he's probably worth $20 million now or whatever it's
Which
down
is
to.
A lot of money.
Absolutely.
Assuming he can get it out. And so the question is,
I don't think he's sold much. One thing I will give him credit, I don't think he's sold many shares. So I give him credit for that.
I mean, I've got sympathy for true believers. I've got, especially got sympathy for true believers that miss their golden window and end up, you know, finding it hard to get out. This is how I'm going to summarise what I understand your views to be. I don't really have anything against him personally because I don't know him personally, but I really think that some claims he made about the business probably were not right. And I don't love how he's run the business, and I especially don't love his COVID views. And I think this business has missed its window of opportunity, and there might be no way back for this business now. That's, I'm going to summarise your views as that.
Yep.
And my one offset to those views, because I feel less passionately about all of that, but my one offset to this is, that could all be true. The one offset is, if you believe that there could still be value in the model, then maybe you think someone like an Airtasker should scoop them up and augment the Airtasker business and take their customer base. And
two different, Airtasker's a local business, so a local Australian, now UK business. I'm using Airtasker at the moment. I'm getting some stuff fixed at home. I think it's Airtasker's a great platform. And I'm not against the platform. I just think it's been badly executed. It's been outdone by Upwork. He claimed he was number one when he wasn't. Forget my views. The share price is telling you what this business has been for shareholders, and it probably shouldn't be listed.
I definitely agree with that. I think, you know, unless there is some way to arrest the revenue fall, because the revenue is not even high enough to make a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
Unless there's a way to arrest that revenue fall, I agree with you. Like, this needs to get off the ASX. It doesn't seem like it's got a happy future on the ASX.
And with that, we'll move on to our third story, which is looking at the rise and rise of gaming. This podcast is brought to you by Bowden Financial. Not only are Bowden one of the best wealth managers going around, but they also offer an incredible product called Group Employee Benefits. And when I heard about this, I immediately spoke to my CFO and told him, we've got to look into this. Group Employee Benefits is essentially a pooled income protection and life insurance policy, but at group level for all your team. These policies can cost individuals more than $10,000 every year. But by using Bowden, businesses can get a group policy, which ends up being far more cost effective, potentially as low as 1% of group wages. The real kicker is that the benefit to employees is so significant, they're much less likely to leave your business. It's like giving everyone a pay rise, but only paying a small fraction of it. If, like me, you're interested in learning more about group employee benefits, please call Bowden directly on 02-4937-0270 or go to bowdenfinancial.com.au to find out more. Now, back to the pod. Look, last week, Adir, you attended the PAX Oz in Melbourne, which was a huge celebration of gaming and gaming culture at the Melbourne Exhibition Centre, with literally tens of thousands of other attendees. The scale of gaming is, of course, massive. According to a report by Superdata Research, the global gaming market was valued at $159.3 billion in 2020. And that includes revenue from console games, PC games, mobile games, and esports. To put that in perspective, the music industry was valued at $19.1 billion in 2020, while the movie industry was worth around $41 billion. That means the gaming industry is more than three times as valuable as music and four times as valuable as the movie sector. And since then, the gap has widened significantly, with gaming going from strength to strength. Adir, you're a gamer or a gaming fan. Tell me about your views on the sector.
Before I tell you my take on gaming, I want to ask you some questions, okay? So, PAX.
Yeah.
There's one PAX on the west coast of the US. There's one PAX on the east coast of the US. I took my two kids with me who are 17 and 14. They both love, between like and madly love gaming. And then there's one PAX in Melbourne. That's the whole...
Really?
Yeah, because... Not to make this political, but the previous Liberal government, which I think was about 170,000 years ago in Victoria.
The Baillieu government.
Yeah, they basically, I think, provided funding and brought this thing to Melbourne. And so let me ask you this question. It goes from Friday to Sunday, 3 days. It was sold out every day. How many tickets do you think they sell every day?
5,000.
100,000.
100,000 tickets.
100,000 a day.
My Lord.
So it was huge.
That's incredible.
A huge number of the people there are dressed up in cosplay. You know what that
is? I assume you were dressed up as Princess Leia.
Dressing up as like your favourite characters. I dressed up as a guy taking his two kids and trying to not have too much fun. I'm not sure that he's having too much fun.
100,000. How do you fit 100,000 people in that?
It's the whole thing. It's huge. It goes through all parts of the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre. Yeah. All parts of it.
Yeah.
It's enormous. Nintendo had a huge stand there. Next to them was Sony. Next to them was Microsoft. There were all of these other production studios, hardware people, you know, Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, which streams gaming. They were there.
Yeah.
This is huge.
What do? You play the games?
Yeah, there was so Nintendo brought some games that were playable, which was fun. I played it with my son and daughter.
Like an hour long to play these games?
20 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Not too bad. Sony brought a Sonic game, which was pretty... I watched my son play it, which was fun. You know, there's also a whole other section, which is board games.
Oh, yeah.
And so I don't... Like, some people might think board games are Monopoly.
Yeah, which, that's what I was going to say. It was a Monopoly.
Yeah, so Monopoly is more, I would call it, a random number generator around a board. So a board game would be like... The Settlers of Catan is probably the most well-known board game. You know that board game? I think they've sold 22 million copies of it globally. So this is a whole big universe.
Yeah.
My favourite part of PAX is they have an area which is all the local indie developers from Melbourne, that had other parts of Australia. They had some from New Zealand and Southeast Asia. And so I love going to the Australian ones and looking at what they're developing because, you know, the numbers for video games, they've become quite insane. I mean, you talked about some of the numbers.
Yeah.
You know the way that Oppenheimer – so do you know what Oppenheimer cost to make as a movie?
I'm going to say a couple hundred million.
So 100 mil.
Okay.
And you know what passed $1 billion of ticket sales. That was a big deal. There are many, many games now that cost more than $100 million in development costs would routinely pass $1 billion of sales, and they keep more of the sales because they don't have to have movie theaters to pay. This is just an overwhelmingly enormous industry.
I think a big part of it's been mobile as well. Obviously, delivery to mobile is cheaper and easier. It's more ubiquitous. Everybody's got a mobile. A lot of people have mobiles. How important is do your sons do much mobile gaming or is it mostly console?
So my son and my daughter, well, firstly, your question is very astute and I'm disappointed that you've come out with such a smart comment about games because you're meant to know nothing about them. Mobile gaming, I think, might be close to 2/3 of the total revenue. In fact, if you look at the ads inside mobile games, they vastly exceed the ads on all of the other kind of digital TV streaming platforms. Yeah. Like the revenue is huge. So that has been very dramatic. You know, what I think about mobile gaming and what my son thinks about mobile gaming is like, that's not real gaming. So I like PC games. He likes console games. He likes the Nintendo Switch. How many Nintendo Switches do you think have been sold? So they cost, I'm going to round it out to $500 a pop.
Oh, I'm hazarding a guess, 20 million?
200 million, more than. How many games have been sold for the units? I'm talking units of games. How many units?
10 per console, maybe. So 2 billion?
So I think it's 1.2 billion okay. at the moment. Yeah. So, I mean, these are very big numbers.
Yeah.
Whereas my daughter, she's much more interested in playing. I wouldn't exactly call it mobile games. I'd call it something like Roblox.
Yep.
So Roblox is a platform where different kinds of developers will develop their own games inside the platform.
I think the Roblox share price hasn't done too well for memory, has it? It started incredibly well.
I don't think they make money. I mean, once again, we come back to the point that tech companies just find a way with billions of dollars of revenue to lose cash. And so I think Roblox might also not be making money. The crazy thing about that is that, you know, that is a game that is a particular characteristic of this generation, this like a young generation, where you buy credits with money and you use those credits in-game, and all those credits do is they buy you ways to look better or yeah, have better stuff, sort of skins, but what you buy does not increase your performance in the game yeah. in any way. If you buy, you know what it's called if you can buy something to increase your performance?
What's that called?
Pay to win. Oh, that's okay. what those games. And so most games are not pay to win.
So it's like the Fortnite stuff where everybody's buying this.
Yeah, Fortnite has no pay to win.
Yeah, but it's got so skins and all that stuff.
Correct. And so Fortnite has dipped now. And so
Fortnite's epic, right?
Fortnite is epic. Epic just fired 17% of their workforce.
10 cent.
I'm not sure if they've got a stake in that. That's a good question.
I'm pretty sure it does.
So the thing that Epic was most well known for before they released Fortnite is they have a game engine called the Unreal Engine, and that's the engine on which a large number of games are built, and that was what they were most well known for. And what they are most well known for now, even more than Fortnite in the business community, I would say, is having the Epic fight against Apple about the Epic Game Store and the amount of commission they have to pay to Apple.
Just a background, Tencent acquired a 48.4% stake in Epic in 2012, actually.
Oh, I didn't realise that. I said they just fired 17% of their workforce.
Yeah.
Why they fired 17% of their workforce?
No.
Because they want to make money.
They don't make money?
No.
Okay.
I thought no one makes money. I tell you who makes money.
And Tencent must make money.
Yeah, Tencent is probably one of the top – if you look at total value of a company that is heavily involved in games
– yeah.
they would be in the top three.
Yeah.
Not that gaming revenue is especially significant for them, but, you know, one of the interesting...
Who's number one? Who's the biggest gaming company in the world?
Well, so it depends if you mean the biggest company that has a significant portion of their revenue.
Who makes the most profit from games? Phrase it that way.
It would probably be Sony or Microsoft.
Okay.
Would be. And so let's talk about Microsoft. So Microsoft is buying a game studio... that is called Activision Blizzard.
Literally two floors below where we're talking right now.
Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
And so they are a very big games company. Their revenue would be $8 billion a year from games. Microsoft's revenue from games is probably twice that.
Okay.
So this is a big transaction. There's two titans. By the way, Microsoft's $16 billion in games revenue. It's less than 10% of their revenue.
Yeah.
like they are like probably the number one or number two player in games.
Yeah.
But they're just such an incredible business. It barely touches the sides. And so they've got their Xbox ecosystem. And so that $69 billion deal is, as we said it last week, working its way through various regulators. I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. Like, it looks like it's going to happen. And, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years, Microsoft has been snapping up all of these different studios, which is the most well-known studio. I like this. I never get to ask the questions. Now I'm asking, what's the most well-known studio that they bought?
The Call of Duty one, that's Activision, right?
That's Activision.
I don't know. What is the most well-known?
Mojang.
Who?
Mojang.
Do you know what Mojang is? Well, Killer's nodding his head. There's only one guy in this room who doesn't know what Mojang is.
I'll give you a hint. They make the number one game by units sold ever.
Super Mario Brothers?
Well, that's probably, I would say, that's actually not a bad guess. That will be in the top 10.
Sonic?
That's a bad
NBA
guess.
NBA Live? You're
getting colder and colder.
Age of Empires?
I like that you know that game.
I love Age of Empires.
Is that right?
I went to my son, you know... Adrian's got that big e-sport thing.
Yeah.
Adrian Giles owns.
Adrian Giles,
what's it called?
Yeah.
What's the
Fortress?
Fortress Games.
I could not speak about that highly enough.
It's great. I had a YPO event there and went there. It was amazing. Adrian obviously YPO.
We might do an event there. I haven't told you about that.
I went there. It was amazing setup. And I went there, went back with my son because he gave us the free voucher thing and used it. And went with my son and his son's mate and son's mate's dad, who's a good guy. And they're playing Fortnite or whatever. And I'm looking through this list of games. They have Age of Empires on there. I used to love Age of Empires 2. I used to love it. And the other guy liked it as well. So they were playing whatever, Fortnite. We were playing Age of Empires. It was
well, there's good news for you, just to digress before I tell you which game. game company they bought and what they make. Age of Empires 2, so there's a... Because it looks... By the way, it looks pretty bad now. It hasn't aged well, but there's a remastered version of it. You can go to something called Steam. It's like a platform for downloading and playing games, and you can go and buy the Age of Empires remastered version.
Yeah.
And there you go. You can relive your childhood.
I like the old
version. Yeah, no, I think that was a great game. So what Mojang made...
We should play it. We can maybe stream it on Twitch.
On Twitch. It was like we would lose our entire audience would be gone within 15 seconds.
Very two people would watch it.
So Mojang is Minecraft.
Ah, okay.
So Microsoft bought that and owns it.
And Minecraft's still popular?
Still popular.
Yeah, my son plays it a bit, but not as much as Fortnite.
It was a very cheap game. That was one of the reasons it became. It was a $20 or $25 game.
Yeah.
And they don't suck more money off
you. So I knew Microsoft owned, and you didn't know Microsoft owned that.
This Activision deal will be the next enormous step in Microsoft's gaming strategy. And I think this industry is... it's not at the very beginning. I was at the very beginning of gaming. When I was a kid.
Tell me you had a gaming business.
I used to write some games.
Of course.
I mean, I don't think I sold any of them, but I put them up on shareware and bulletin boards. I read some games. I think there's actually nothing more fun for a kid. I even watch kids today. Like my son codes heavily in Minecraft. Yeah. He's very good at it. And my daughter is coding as well.
Great.
He loved the feeling of a kid coding a game and being able to play it.
Yes.
Is pretty fantastic.
I think I'm not a big gamer. I used to play Age of Empires and Civilization 25 years ago, but I'm not a big gamer. But I much prefer my kids playing a game than watching TV than watching iPad. It feels like it's a more productive use of it's intellectual. You're getting fast Twitch or whatever.
Let me tell you how into gaming I am.
You're still into gaming?
Oh, yes,
we definitely have to play Age of Empires one day down at Adrian's joint.
So I would still buy 1 to 2 games a month.
1 to 2 a month.
A month.
Between that and your coffee expenditure, how do you afford to buy these fancy jackets you're wearing right now?
I put them on my wish. People can't see us, but I am the best dressed.
You are incredibly
podcast host, maybe in history.
It's a shame we don't have YouTube. Like me and Keelan look like bums on the street. You got a pocket square.
Because I'm going to a wedding. That's why.
Yeah.
I'm the most casual dresser in general. Although you wear shorts to every recording, I can't even remember the topic we were talking about. I really wanted to answer the question that you were saying. No, I know the topic is gaming, but so I'm telling you about how much gaming I do. So I buy a couple of games a month.
Yep.
And I would play 10 to 50 hours a month.
10 to 50 hours? Is this with other people, presumably?
I mostly play solo gaming.
What games are you playing? Minecraft?
No, I'm not really so into Minecraft. I would play... I'm very broad... I mean, don't say that. I'm very broadly interested in a lot of different game genres. So I'd play something like... Have you heard of a game called Fallout 4? I was very big into that for a while. That's like an open world, post-apocalyptic first-person shooter.
No, I've heard of that. Is that like what's Last of Us, that kind of thing?
Well, The Last of Us 2 is one of the games that cost $150 million
to
make.
That?
I've played it. I don't love that particular game. But then on the flip side, you have these games. So I'll play all sorts of games. But the flip side I want to say is this. The beauty of Steam, and this is why I think the economy of games is fundamentally shifting, is at one end you have these things that have become basically movie studios that are ploughing 100 million and they're trying to get hits and they have billion-dollar hits and that is the movie studio
the VC model.
Yeah, the VC model, exactly. And so that's you have at one end. But what you have at the other end, which you don't really have in these other entertainment industries, is you have one-person studios or two people and it's just them, and they build whole games. And the reason that that exists and becomes popular in gaming, where it doesn't in movies, is there are these universal platforms that people are using, like Steam, and like Epic Games is trying to be one of them. And Steam will just go and start promoting these indie games that on algorithms that look like they're becoming popular.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, one of my favorite games I've ever played is called Banished. It's considered in a way like the gold standard of city builders. One guy built the entire game.
It's like the Blair Witch Project of games.
Right. And so Blair Witch kind of became famous just out of luck, right?
Yeah.
But this is an algorithmic business model that goes and finds indie games that look like they're becoming popular and all of a sudden they've sold 2 million units at $20 or $30 and these are two or three developers and then they can go on and build
studios. This is a new topic. And my issue with games these days and movies these days as well, maybe I'm getting a bit old compared to Keelan.
This feels like a conversation that starts Back in my day. I used to love games like GoldenEye. That's simple.
GoldenEye on the Nintendo 64 was one of the great games ever. By the way, the Nintendo 64 was not a very popular games console.
No, except for GoldenEye. But if you think back to movies in the 80s and 90s and games in the 90s, because you didn't have the special effects and all the stuff, you talk about $100 million plus budget, they focus more on classic gameplay, or in the case of movies, stories. You look at those, the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the Back to the Future, all these great stories. And now, because they've got both movies and games have the ability to use special effects, they've forgotten about gameplay and they focus on the wrong thing. So it's just, to me, that I've lost the purity of why there isn't an Age of Empires or a Civilization or a Ferris Bueller's Day Off in the movie realm. Is everything got too fancy and too complicated and they forgot about the classic art of storytelling.
So my response to that would be, firstly, there is Civilization has continued as a franchise. Civilization 6 is a great game, like I played often. There's now copies of Civilization that are very good. So I would say I'm basically going to disagree with everything that you just said about games, but I'll be quite specific. So there are two different kinds of games now. There are games where they spend lots of money and graphics is a huge focus. And then there's games, the most extreme is you get 8-bit type games at the other end where the simple graphics is part of the beauty of the game. But certainly gameplay at the simpler end is the heavy focus. But the reason I'll also agree with you at the top end is I think that the top end has started to write scripts and do acting that is competitive with movies. There's a game called Red Dead Redemption 2, RDR2, another $100 million plus game, billion-dollar sales by the same studio that does Grand Theft Auto. Grand Theft Auto, one of the best-selling games
What's that
ever.
Called?
It's called Rockstar Games, owned by Take-Two Interactive, publicly listed in the US.
Yeah.
And so the storyline in that game was as good as the storyline in a hit movie, better than the storyline in the superhero movies.
Yeah.
So I think that we're in this quite incredible age of gaming, basically. I think it's incredible. It's the last thing I'm going to tell you about games, okay? There is a huge difference in how much the CEOs get paid to run gaming businesses in the US and in Japan. So Japan is actually, I would say Japan is the spiritual home of gaming much more than the US is. And so we can't say how much the guy that runs Activision is going to get when he sells, because he's going to get $500 million, but that's because he actually...
Sheryl Sandberg's ex-boyfriend.
Exactly. I think so. I shouldn't
Bobby
say exactly.
Coding,
I think so. Oh, my God. Yeah. You're very across that. And so he's getting $500 million because he invested $50 million and did a buyout and put it together. So he's not getting paid as a CEO.
Yeah.
But like the EA CEO, which is EA Sports Games and a whole lot of other games.
FIFA.
Yeah, exactly. So they're $100 million each franchises per year, development costs. He last year, I think, got $40 million US pay.
Yeah.
And this year got $30 million US. And his company is worth X, I'm going to call it. I think it's $30 billion or something like that, EA. But let's call it X.
Yeah.
Nintendo,
yeah.
The Japanese have a completely different attitude towards this stuff. And so the current CEO of Nintendo earns about $2 million USD as a salary, which, by the way, is a very good salary, just to put it out there.
Sure.
And his company is three times the size of EA. And back in the last story, I'll tell you about just the different attitudes of leadership in this industry between Japan and the US is that back in... I think it was 2012 or 2013, there was a console that Nintendo put out called the Wii U. It was like the flop of flops.
Yes, Wii was good and this was a subsequent.
The Wii was a hit
and
Wii U was a bomb. It was kind of, Wii U was the halfway house between the Wii and where they would end up with the Switch.
Yep.
They just had to get it wrong first before they got it right.
Yeah.
And it bombed. And they really, sales were going backwards. And the guy that ran it at the time, his surname was Iwata, he died in 2015, unfortunately. Rather than firing staff, he basically said, we're just going to put everybody's wages down, starting with mine and my management team, that will be dropping by 50% until we get back to growth.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting the completely different business principles of leadership. Not to say Nintendo, I think Nintendo fundamentally hates their fans and players, to be honest. So, it's not to say that they're a better company. It's just a different management approach in the US and in Japan.
After the break, we'll go on to our final story, the one that we've all been waiting for, Goy to Watch. There are lots of digital agencies out there, but if you want to work with the best and get next-level analytics data and even media mix modelling, just like the huge advertisers do,
then you've got to speak to Ori and the team at Bench Media. Call them on 1300 049 498 or go to benchmedia.com. And we're back with our final story of the week, the one that we've had countless listeners email, text, call about. It's been on the story on everyone's lips, probably the biggest story in corporate Australia, and that is who has won the Richard Goyder bet. Keelan, play the music. And as that music indicates, Richard Goyder literally 4 days ago announced that he was resigning as the chairman of Qantas, as one of us predicted. There is some complexity here that he said he will be resigning before the next AGM in 2024. So he is claiming he'll stick around another year. Adir, this has added some element of intrigue in the bet.
Well, let's be clear about what happened here. This announcement came out before I even saw this announcement in the media, because occasionally I got to do some other stuff. I get a message from you quoting Paul Keating to me. You should say the quote that you sent to me. What did you send to me?
Well, I think I remember Paul Keating when he won that 1993 election that nobody thought Paul Keating would win. It was the GST election, from memory, against John Hewson, who's that sort of liberal leader back then. And Paul Keating won, and he told an adoring public, this is the sweetest victory of them all.
So I get that message from you, and I'm like, hang on a second, and I look at it, and what I see is that it's like they've conspired to make our bet as convoluted as humanly possible. And so I said to you, I don't think this is over. Yes, he's resigning, but we said in 6 months, and like, you know, if we would have had a bet that said, you bet that he will announce that at some – this is your bet. I bet that at some point in the next 6 months, Richard Goyder will announce that at some point he will be resigning. Then I would give you that bet, no problems. But this is the most convoluted bet. We should say you were very confident.
I was confident
enough to call an early election. I thought, no, there's no way. And so we haven't seen the results of this, but I put up a poll. And I feel like you're exceptionally confident, right, about this poll.
I was confident about the whole Goyder thing,
right,
as it's transpired.
No, but don't back away from this. If this poll is going to be the determination of who is paying, and so whatever this poll says, we're going to go with, right?
I wasn't sure we're going with the poll, but I'm happy to go with the poll.
Well, because, you know, if we don't go with the poll, then we're just going to have this argument about linguistic technicalities and various precedents in life for the next three
hours. Before we talk about the poll, let's talk about sort of what's happened here. So we'll leave the poll till the end. So what's happened was Goyder said he's going before 2024 AGM. I'm 99.9% confident. Actually, I'm 100% confident he leaves well before then. So the only reason he's not leaving early is they don't have a replacement. And we talked about this last week. So so one of the great strokes of Joyce and Goyder. So Joyce, the reason why Joyce was CEO for so long is every time somebody came as a potential successor, he'd fire them or move them to somewhere else. So Joyce ingeniously never had a successor. Goyder kind of does the same. In all of his boards, he has no natural successor. So in Woodside, there's no successor. In Qantas, there is no natural. You look at the Qantas board, it's a pretty ordinary board.
What are the AFL has got lots of potential successors on the AFL board.
But they're all too busy. Robin Bishop's too busy. Like they can't take the role.
They're all too. They all say they're too busy.
Paul's not going to do it. Like they're all too busy.
All right, but they all. Maybe if they're busy with a day job, they can't do it. But there are a few. I think there are some people on there that say they're too busy because no one wants to, you know, show their hand too early. But if they were asked, they would do it. I think the AFL. I always say this to you. I think the AFL has a good board and is run well. That's my
view. Remember, it took him 2 years to fill those two vacancies in the AFL board as well, which is.
Yeah,
terrible.
I read that. To be honest with you, I wasn't across that at all.
I think the replacements are good. I think it was Matt DeBoer, who's a fantastic guy. Yeah.
Runs a VC fund.
Matt DeBoer runs Athletic Ventures, which is a great VC, and Matt's a great guy and a fantastic appointment. But back to Qantas. So what we also saw was Maxine Brenner and Jacqueline Hay are both retiring after the half-year results in February. And Michael Lestrange, who's had a torrid time. He was on the Rio Tinto board. He got booted off that. He left that. He's now leaving. This Lestrange was planned to leave now. So that's four board members going. Then you've got Todd Sampson, the T-shirt guy. He's up for re-election at the board meeting in a couple of weeks.
I don't think he wears a T-shirt to the board meeting.
I reckon he does.
Really?
I think he would. Have you ever seen him not wear a T-shirt?
I would. Even I, who basically wears jeans
You're wearing a pocket square right now.
I wear a jeans and a t-shirt and runners everywhere.
I think you had a top hat on when you came in.
When I go to board meetings.
Tails.
Oh, I do wear a t-shirt to board meetings, to be honest with you. I take all of that back.
But you got four board members leaving. You got Doug Parker, the American Airlines guy, and Heather Smith staying. Belinda Hutchinson, I think, is – what I actually should say is it's – I'd hold directors far less accountable here than Goyder, for what – like, ultimately, it's the chairman and the CEO who should carry the can. Directors are less – much less influential. So that's why whilst we sort of give Todd Sampson a bit of a ribbing, he probably couldn't influence all that much there. The likes of Belinda Hutchinson probably hasn't influenced all that much. Maxine probably hasn't influenced all that much. So, yes, they're going. I think Goyder was the main one to go. He was cap in hand with Joyce, best CEO by the length of a straight, that he lasted as long as he did. The tin ear this guy has, he's famous. I spoke to a very good fund manager this week, one of the sort of bigger fund managers in the country, and asked him his view on this. He said Goyder famously has a tin ear, and which is why it took him so long to go. Literally a couple of weeks ago, this is Goyder's statement. Goyder told a radio interview that the latest read I've got is that people want me to continue to do the role and I think I'm well suited to do it. This guy is off the reservation.
But Joe, that might be true.
It's clearly not true because clearly a shareholder told him to get staffed.
I think it's got – listen, you and I have always had very different views on this. My view is there are lots of people in business – that are nasty. There's a whole heap of people in business that are incompetent, let's call it.
Yeah.
There's a small number of people in business that are just dishonest.
Yeah.
And what I think you have here is people that have made some wrong decisions and made mistakes, but that are actually, like, I think the competence is much higher than you do, but also like nice and not crooks. And
I never said they were crooks.
No, I know you didn't. And so what I'm saying is I think it's probably right that they should go. And I also agree that my personal view is the time frame and the way it's been handled is also probably right, but I just feel less hostile about it. But my biggest question is this. If I do get invited to be a member of the chairman's lounge, are you prepared to come as a guest when we travel?
Of course.
You are.
I come as a guest.
All right. But you might have to come incognito.
With one of those Groucho Marx. We work with Qantas. We have a great – let's be really clear. Richard Goyder and Alan Joyce aren't Qantas, and that was the big mistake they made. I think Joyce thought he was Qantas. Qantas is a 101-year-old institution that's one of the great Australian companies that has – 20,000 employees. They are Qantas. It's the staff. It's not Alan Joyce who doesn't work there anymore. It's not Richard Goyder who won't work there. And these guys aren't Qantas. Let's be really clear. Qantas is made up of tens of thousands of incredibly hardworking Australians and people who live outside Australia who have done a great job. Qantas Loyalty is one of the great businesses of Australia. It's a phenomenal franchise. It's been very badly damaged by two people who won't be there. One's not there, one won't be there. I think we too often conflate individual, and we do it with founders, but at least there's some equity there. Alan Joyce and Goyder didn't found Qantas. They were the hired help. They were brought in to try and maximise wealth for shareholders, which they haven't done. They were also brought in as stewards of the Qantas customer base, which they haven't done. They were also stewards of taxpayer dollars. They got $2.7 billion during COVID, which they gave to shareholders. Like many Australians, I love Qantas. I've always been very anti-high executive pay because I don't think executives should earn what they earn. We talked about in our last segment. Doesn't mean I'm not. That means I'm pro shareholder, pro company, pro customer. So we can be pro a lot of things, and I think Goyder and Joyce have done a huge amount of damage to what is possibly the greatest brand in the country and a brand that we should all be proud of.
So you're going to get to the poll. Am I ever going to see
your face again? So you actually asked on LinkedIn who won the bet about Richard Goyder quitting as Qantas chairman within 6 months. So obviously, there was a bit of controversy because again, he's leaving potentially after a year. Option one, he quit, Adam wins. Option two, he's not gone yet, Adir wins. Option three, I'm too indecisive. Let's forget about option three.
Well, option three, I kind of felt like whoever put that down, that you just, they're people that should hang their head in shame, right? You can't sit on the fence. You've got to make a choice.
Unfortunately, there was only 15 of them, or 20 of them. In terms of who supported Adir, 20% of people.
Oh, my God. That's terrible.
Adam wins, 71%. This is almost Tin Pot Republic kind of stuff.
How many of those votes are yours?
One was mine.
Oh, by the way, you probably voted, didn't you?
Well, I had to see the result.
Oh, I see.
Okay, I'll take one. So let's round it down to 70% then, in case that my vote.
I would have voted for you because I thought you'd lose it.
Well, ultimately, so the people have spoken. Thank you to our contrarian army, who we love, for voting so smartly yet again. Probably the smartest people in the country listen to this show.
It's amazing that we have such a, I mean, it's a lot of votes.
Like,
we
only put it up for listeners.
Yeah, it's like eight hours of voting.
How smart are they? I had a lot of people contact me, and they were emotionally invested in this result. Some people were visibly angry that I thought you might win the bet after he took a year to resign.
People were all in favour of me.
Well, apparently,
someone's got to stand up for
corporate
Australia. Only
20% of people were. Apparently, this is the win of the little man.
They probably felt bad.
The bloke
for
with the pocket square has not won this bet, so it's a huge win for the battler. We'll work out where
well,
we go.
Well, you've got to choose the restaurant that we go to. Think about it. You've got a week to think about it.
Are we eating next week?
In November.
I wanted to dwell in this victory a bit longer, bask in the glory a bit longer.
Sure, this gift voucher has an expiry date.
It's 3 years, new regulations.
Is that the regulations?
You can't book breakage for 3 years in Australia these days.
Really? I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah, so if you've got a gift card and they break it in a year, you can get your money back.
Well, you've got 3 years. It won't be inflation adjusted.
Well, that could severely diminish the value. We'll go in the next couple of months. I want to squeeze this lemon a bit longer. We'll talk about Richard Goiter again, no doubt, as weeks go by, because clearly the story isn't over. And there's also a question on, nothing against Vanessa Hudson, but she was obviously closely linked with Alan Joyce. My view is they probably need to bring in someone external. Ultimately, this was Goiter's appointment. And Joyce's appointment, and this is no disrespect to Vanessa, who could be an incredible CEO. I think they need to bring the person who I think will be the ultimate person. This will get everybody hating me because obviously Jane will hate hearing this, but Nick Rawlach, who runs loyalty at Velocity, who runs Velocity Program, who we work with, is a superstar exec. He used to work at Qantas. Remember they sued him when he left, and that was pretty spiteful. But he's probably the best aviation exec in the country at the moment, after Vanessa and Jane, and he will be an incredible appointment. He's worked at Qantas. Superstar. It's someone like that who I think would be a fantastic CEO of Qantas, who brings a bit of a clean look at the business.
I would like to make these three observations. One is, I hope Richard Goiter stays at the AFL. I think he's done an excellent job.
I think that could be Goiter watch too. I think he's not going to last
a year.
But
you could say I'm conflicted because of Catapult, but I actually mean it completely candidly. Like, I think he's done a great job at the AFL. Number two, I hope that Vanessa Hudson gets 12 months at least to show what she can do with the airline.
I think she'll get 12 months. I don't know how much longer she'll get than that.
And number three, that I'm surprised that nobody has mentioned this, but the two largest domestic airlines in Australia are now both run by women.
Mm.
And I'm sure that is a first.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a significant development in my view. So
I can't think of really any airlines. Most of the airlines in the US are run by males. Pretty sure the European Ryanair certainly run by a male.
Yeah,
We
can guess that Qatar and Emirates are probably
run by men. Qatar certainly is, and Emirates certainly is. So yeah, it's very unusual, and both very accomplished, successful entrepreneurs. Both very successful executives who've had long and successful careers.
That's a happy note to leave the podcast on.
Thanks, Adia. It was a great episode again. Some work for Keelan in editing, no doubt. But we will. Obviously a very glorious week for one of us, but consolations to you for not quite getting over the line.
You know, I'm the kind of person that can enjoy the happiness of others.
You are an extremely good loser, I must say that. It's been very magnanimous. Hats off to you, and I'll try and be a good winner, but it'll be tough. And we'll wrap up the episode there. Look forward to seeing you all next week. As always, a big thanks to our incredible sponsors, Bench Media, Remont Advisory and Bowden Financial for making the show happen. Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to AdamJSchwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Keelan Brown. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and tell your friends.